Welcome to the Philharmonic Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 9:07 British Summer Time. Today is October 22nd, and of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. And the bulk of the action that has happened this week has been centered around what's been going on with the US dollar, and it continues to rally in here, particularly against currencies where the governments have been bleating about the strength of their respective currencies relative to the dollar. So it's rallied by whatever a fraction of a Brazilian real is in the last week, and it has also rallied quite impressively against the Swiss franc. Against the euro, it has been less impressive. The euro continues to hold in the region of the below the 140 or $1.40 level. The British pound has been a bit weaker following the announcement of the fiscal tightening that is going to go on in the UK. The Australian dollar continues to hold just below parity, and the Canadian dollar had weakened quite a bit in relatively sharp order a couple of days this week, and has given up about 3 cents of its recent advance. So the dollar has found at least short-term support, and it remains to be seen whether this turns into medium-term support. When we look at the dollar index, it has rallied by approximately 2 points, but given the fact that the September rally was in the region of about 3.5 points, so really a move for the dollar in the region of 4 full points for the dollar index would suggest that it has found medium-term support. In the meantime, this pause in the US dollar's decline has put a little bit of pressure on some of these commodities, but they haven't fallen by nearly as much as the US dollar has rallied, and that continues to speak of the fact that it wasn't just the US dollar that was helping to support the commodity markets. So the agriculturals remain really quite firm. The corn, soybean, wheat, and oats have pulled back a little bit into the end of this week, but not by any discernible margin, and they continue to hold what has been an impressive advance over the last month. Silver has perhaps pulled back more than most. It hit a high of just under $25 a couple of weeks ago, and at its low today, it was in the region of $22.84 and finished above $23. This has been a relatively sharp pullback, but it hasn't been nearly as sharp as it could have been. So that continues to look like a relatively orderly consolidation, and the size of the downward dynamics that we've had do suggest that silver has hit a near-term peak, and it really would need to push above $25 to reassert the medium-term uptrend. But the type of action that we've seen does not suggest that silver has peaked in the long term. This is, in probably all likelihood, the beginning of a reversion towards the mean, and given the speed with which it has come down, there is probably a likelihood that it will be able to hold on to a good portion of its advance over the last few months, which really has been remarkably impressive. But it is very, very overextended relative to the 200-day moving average, and there is plenty of room for it to consolidate and allow that moving average to catch up with it. The gold price has also pulled back this week, and has given up about $50 of its advance, and it's finishing out the week in the region of $1,328. So still well above the $1,300 level. And while gold hasn't become nearly as overextended as silver has, it also has probably hit a near-term peak. So the risk remains that these precious metals will consolidate, and we'll have to look for somewhere else for a position of leadership, because they've at least paused in the short term. US Treasuries this week were a bit weaker. They had rallied from their September low for much of the last month, but have given up a bit of that advance into the end of this week, and they're currently in the region of 132, just perhaps a little bit lower than that. You continue to have these questions about whether we're going to have quantitative easing or not in the USA, and particularly in the UK. And that has helped to support the government bond prices in those two jurisdictions. Also, the same is true for Japan. You don't have nearly the same speculation that there'll be quantitative easing in the Eurozone, and as a result, the Eurobonds have been considerably weaker than their other counterparts, and they're currently testing the lows around the 130 level. And I think an upward dynamic, which is sustained for more than a day or two and is really quite clear, would really be required to question the potential for this to complete a medium-term top and move a little bit lower in here. This has also been an important week for oil because it has been up and down like a yo-yo over the last 10 days or so, but it continues to hold above the $80 level. Now, when one looks at the daily chart, it's been going sideways for such a long time that it looks remarkably volatile. When one takes a step back and looks at it over 5 or even 10 years, this range over the last year is relatively tight. Now, there have been some really quite extraordinary bounces from both sides of the range, but oil is holding in the region of $80. That's the upper side of the range. The upper limit is in the region of 85 to 87, but it continues to look like the chances for a successful upward break are greater than the scope for a retest of the lower side of this range. And that would suggest that oil, which has been a laggard compared with some of the other industrial commodities, could be joining the party in the not too distant future. For the industrial metal complex, copper has gone right up to test the $4 level and pulled back rather sharply, but has held the vast majority of its gains, and it's firmed again into the end of this week, and it's currently in the region of $3.80. Copper had probably been the one that was most well, one of the ones that had pushed up to test a previous area of psychological resistance. Tin remains the clear leader in the sector and has held the really very impressive advance that it's posted over the last few months. But the other industrial metals are all pushing higher, particularly zinc and lead, who failed to sustain little upward breaks yesterday, but reasserted again in here today and held their advances into the end of the session. So that's really good positive action, and it suggests that with the commodity complex firming, not just in the industrial metals but in the food and the soft commodities as well, that the likelihood that we're going to have some form of inflationary pressure feeding through from emerging markets into developed, or probably more accurately, from progressing markets into regressing markets, that inflation certainly can't be wiped off the table in here. When we look at the potential for quantitative easing, and there really has been a remarkable amount of commentary about that over the last month or two, it's by no means assured that we are going to have quantitative easing. The weakness of the dollar is a bit of an impediment to an additional round of money supply expansion in here. The USA's trading partners are already beginning to not only to complain, but also to take some substantive action in the form of currency controls to check the advances of their respective currencies. Among those, in particular, have been Brazil, but there have been a number of Asian countries doing the same. And if they were to massively increase the supply of US dollars, well, that certainly wouldn't be any good for the currency. It would help the manufacturing sector in the USA, but it would also push up the price of commodities in US dollars. And while it would support the US treasuries for as long as the US Treasury is buying them, who else is going to want to buy them? Because they depend enormously on China and Japan, and while Japan is in a mess all of its own making, the Chinese will have a lot to say about the dilution of their investment in US treasuries. So, the potential for quantitative easing, while certainly in existence and will become considerably more likely if the pressure on the US economy intensifies, it's by no means certain, and it is a rather atomistic approach. when one goes back to what Bernanke talked about at his Jackson Hole speech, he talked about moderating the Fed's statements, and that really is a very soft policy. In other words, he wants to try and talk the market up, and they've certainly done that with the US dollar, which was pretty much confirmed by Secretary Geithner in here this week, where he said that a weak US dollar was desirable and rolled back on that the day after. But the other thing that Bernanke talked about at Jackson Hole was putting a negative interest rate on deposits at the Fed. And from my perspective, that does look like a more suitable solution, because the U.S. financial institutions have more than $1 trillion on deposit at the Fed. They are not lending to each other, and they're not lending it out to small businesses and homeowners either. And that's a problem. The quantitative easing approach is unlikely to change that. So forcing them to lend by making them pay to keep their money at the Fed may not be such a bad idea, and I think would probably be a better solution than quantitative easing. The big argument in favor of quantitative easing is the fact that you need interest rates low to allow for the massive reset of adjustable rate mortgages that's happening into 2011 in particular, but a little bit in 2012 as well. So they will need to continue to keep interest rates low, which does make shorting US treasuries a little bit of a risky proposition, because the government is always going to be standing there and can change the rules at will. When we look at the extent to which currencies, particularly in the USA and the UK, are being debauched at the moment, it is a really sound argument for looking at gold as a long-term investment, and that's certainly what's been happening over the last couple of months in particular. Now, gold has probably hit at least a short-term peak. Seasonally, it's still quite a favorable period for gold, so maybe this is only a short-term peak and we see new highs sometime in the new year. We will have to rely on what the chart action is telling us, and right now it's telling us that gold is at a medium-term peak, and that this little reaction that we've got right now isn't yet over. And I think the same prognosis can be rolled out to just about all of the precious metals and gold shares. However, given the fact that the supply of fiat currency is only set to increase, the potential for additional strength in the US dollar price of gold remains really quite impressive. And while gold has been rallying for the last 10 years, there's nothing that has happened yet to question the consistency of this advance. And a consistent trend is a trend in motion, which means that the consistency characteristics that we've identified and the rhythm of this trend is still very much in motion. The only inconsistency we've had is that the 18-month progression of little ranges, well, I suppose 18-month ranges aren't exactly little, but 18-month ranges, which are followed by impressive breaks to the upside, has shortened up. And that's consistent with the third psychological perception stage of major bull markets, in that demand really then starts to pick up and widen the gulf between supply, and that helps to drive these markets higher faster. In the final stages of a major bull market, and since gold has been rallying for 10 years, and when one looks at it relative to the Dow Jones in particular, where we have lots of back history, just like we do for gold, then it's already had a big part of its advance already. But it's when you get to the final stage that the numbers start to get big, because for the Dow Jones gold ratio to go from 8 to 5, that's a very large move, probably in both instruments, to get to that level. And it would probably require gold fever. Participation in gold has certainly increased, and the range of instruments that one can invest in has absolutely exploded in the last 5 years in particular. It was only last Sunday that I heard on the radio people advertising putting money into bullion on a cost averaging basis. So they were extorting people, or exhorting people, I should say, to put a percentage of their income into gold every week, and indeed every month. And that's the kind of action that is consistent with a third psychological perception stage. It's at the moment, gold is viewed as a hedge. It's viewed as something that is a sound investment in a worst case scenario. We're probably not yet at a place where it's considered that gold can't go down, and that would really start to ring alarm bells that we're coming to the end of this bull market. I think that we're probably at the beginning of the third psychological perception stage, and that means that gold has plenty of upside potential from here. Gold is benefiting enormously from the deterioration in standards of governance that has occurred right across the G4. On the other hand, the other theme that competes for our attention is the expansion of the global middle class, which is being led by the world's population centers in Asia, and that growth in the middle class in Asia is helping to support commodity-based economies right around the world, and companies that dominate their niches and have access to the growth of the middle class and the growth of the global consumer are also benefiting over the long term. So while gold is a hedge against a rather debilitating situation in the USA and in Europe and Japan, the growth of the middle classes is more optimistic. This is the future, and we're going to see another 1 billion people move from the countryside into the cities across Asia and Latin America over the next decade or two. And that's going to require a massive infrastructure build. There's been a lot of commentary about China and the overbuilding that's gone on in China and the bridges to nowhere. And that's pretty much inevitable in any major bull market. You're going to have probably some ill-advised building. But let's not forget that they've also built a lot of roads to somewhere. And they've built a lot of airports and a lot of railways. They built a lot of homes, and they have raised hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. They're quickly developing their consumer economy, and they're helping to support large numbers of additional people through the social security network and rolling out greater access to healthcare. And that is an amazing achievement when one looks at where China was 30 years ago. And they have a remarkable momentum behind them. So while, yes, there are problems with corruption, and one certainly can't take for granted that a control economy can get it right all the time, they have a large cash surplus. And one can also talk about the liabilities, but the kind of liabilities relative to the cash that China has is the kind of problem that a lot of countries would like to have. So China continues to set the pace in terms of commodity demand, but given the fact that you have hundreds of millions of young people right across Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America who are entering their most productive period of their lives, where they turn into high consumption types of consumers, where they want to have their first house, they want to form families, they want to own a car, and they want all of the consumer goods that people take for granted in the majority of Europe and the USA. And that's creating massive investment opportunities, because with the growth of global middle class, which is being fostered by the outperformance of GDP growth relative to population growth, and the improvement in standards of fiscal, economic, and corporate governance, as well as the governance of the individual states themselves, where lessons have been learned both from the West's mistakes, but also from the Asian financial crisis and the Latin American, various Latin American financial crises. And trade between emerging markets is increasing at an impressive pace. It's looking like that 2010, perhaps 2011, we'll see the GDP of the emerging markets overtake that of the developed markets. And that'll be an important milestone, because the majority of these countries have long-term ambitions. They're not managing their companies or their economies for the next quarter. They're managing them for the next decade and next decades. So that's a different perspective. And they are taking long-term decisions and backing them up with the full force of their attention. And that has been paying dividends. Now, the rare earth metals has received a lot of attention in China, and they are certainly using their access to essential materials to their own benefit. And it certainly brings to mind that countries have interests, not friends. And China is using their access to the vast majority of the world's refining capacity for these metals to its own advantage, and it's going to take a while for the rest of the world to catch up and build their own. China is also investing all over the world and attempting to gain access to the commodities that it needs to fuel its development, not over the next couple of years, but over the next decades. So while there is the lingering threat that China will have some kind of bust, and that is, it's sort of out there on the periphery. I don't believe that that is an immediate threat, and it certainly doesn't, it's not justified from the way that asset markets are performing in China right now, and they have done remarkably well, or particularly since the Mid-Autumn Festival. But that is a threat over the long term. We know that the USA had a number of busts in the 1900s, and it can arguably be said that the 1900s were the USA's century. So we can't rule out that China will have the occasional hiccup, but when looks at the long term, they are doing everything that is necessary to develop their economy and raise even more of their people out of poverty and into the consuming classes. And that in itself looks like a secular theme, but China is not alone, and every other country in the world can look at its example and copy it if it wants to. And India in particular needs to get its act together in terms of the infrastructure that it needs and the exploitation of its own natural resources, because it's got hundreds of millions of young people that are going to be entering the workforce in the not too distant future, and the policies need to be put in place to make sure that India can attain its potential. India has a remarkable entrepreneurial corporate sector, and the performance of the Sensex reflects that vibrant entrepreneurship in the corporate sector. At the government sector, it really is an impediment to growth. And that is probably the opposite problem that China has. So there isn't any country that doesn't have its own problems. And what is important is that the trajectory of governance is seen to be improving, and I think that is the case with the vast majority of the emerging markets, and particularly those population centers in Asia. And that, provided that remains the case, then the confidence level for investors will remain high, and in the absence of some really quite extraordinary mitigating factor, these markets are likely to be sound investment opportunities for a considerable period of time. They will occasionally go through violent reactions and violent pullbacks towards their 200-day moving averages, but for the medium to longer term, these can be viewed as opportunities to enter the market. And likewise, when they do rally spectacularly away from their 200-day moving averages, it's probably a time to take profits, and or at least to take a profit on part of a position. And that is likely to be the case for a considerable period of time. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, but wish all the best to all of you.